have Carl tell us more about Webcool Wineries.
Yes. So I have the very hopefully sufficiently vague title of, well, the one that I have. And so what I plan to talk about today is a bit on the various selections of the astrophysical motivation for the types of binary black holes we think can exist in the universe, and if there is any way of figuring out actually where the binaries we've seen, where their origin is, or what the astrophysical origin is. So I've used this analogy before, but I like it quite a bit, so I'm gonna keep it from that. It's a bit dark on this picture here, but what you see is a humerus bone from a dinosaur. You can look, the screen in the back is a bit better contrast. But most of my, it's just this picture which will be this bad, I think. But this is in many ways.
I like this.
Hope you brought enough coffee. So this bone is very similar to the things we actually see. We see the remnants of the stars that have lived in the universe and are now dead. And most of the time, we see a little fraction of the entire thing. We get some information about this remnant's origin, but usually not very much. Sometimes we are a bit luckier in the sense that we see not just the one little piece of the puzzle, but we can actually see a larger fraction, and sometimes everything, but that's some time away. But then, just because you see a remnant doesn't mean that you actually know what the origin was. So these are three selected cartoons of what this dinosaur was supposed to look like. And even with what I presume is a sufficiently good and well-informed sampling of, like, for example, the color of the dinosaur, these three people disagreed on the specifics. And that's, again, pretty similar. So what do we actually see? We see something like this. So what you have on the bottom is the plus and cross polarizations of the gravitational waves that are emitted by this specific binary black hole. This is a numerical relativity simulation that we did at CETA back in January, I guess, last year, which is consistent with the fourth binary black hole detection we've seen. So the binary called GW17104. And if you look at this, so not just at the waveform, but at the actual black holes at the top, you have quite a lot of information in there. So for example, you see that not just, they're not completely black. So the color indicates the north pole of the spin, for example. So we have spin information, and you see that the orbit wobbles around. So you have precession in here. And also at the very end, you have a little upward rift. So you have the linear kick that's been applied. If we saw exactly this all the time, it'd be great. We'd know everything. But we don't. And this goes back to what Salva talked about yesterday.
So this is the event where you have that chi effective is bigger than zero?
No, for this one, chi effective is consistent with zero.
Okay.
So the spins shown here are a decent representation of a binary which is, yeah, so which is consistent with the source,
yeah.
But it's not any particularly specific parameters that goes in there. But in practice, this is partially what we're after. We're trying to figure out how the stars were born and how they evolved and how they lived. And so the stars shown here appear at least to be non-rotating, so they're not going to be very good at forming massive binary black holes. But if you have a higher rotation, which I will come back to in a minute, these are pretty good as a typical progenitor for some of the binaries we've seen.
So how does, you'll explain how spin, and so these stars are not spin, they're just stuck to each other. Each other like that, like a...
Yeah, no, so the fact that we're rotating around this is just so that it looks pretty, I think.
Yeah.
And then...
It's like, this is the common envelope.
No, so this would probably be some more direct mass transfer period. So if you had a common envelope, then you would have massive cloud of gas, of an envelope around it. But yeah, so again, we have the dinosaur, we think. So then a way of looking at what we think the origin could be is also to compare against binaries and stars that exist today, or somewhere in the cosmic past, and then try to compare that against the remnant binaries we have seen. But at the same time, just because you have a dinosaur, you had a dinosaur in the past, that could still mean that you have a little bird in the current universe. So the direct translation between what we currently see and what we could have seen in the past isn't as clear as we'd like sometimes. So I'll start off the actual talk with discussing some formation channels and then go into some more specifics and how you can try to distinguish between them. And I'll come back to these specific plots in a minute. But in general, the gravitational waves observables we have and the ones we care about are the mass, or the masses of the binary components, and more specifically, the mass ratio, which can tell us something about the binary formation history, and also the mass magnitude. So if you have a really heavy pair of black holes or something really light. The spins are probably in practice the best gauge for connecting what we see at the moment with the formation history. And especially if you have spin precession. And in this, I count both actual observation of precessing spins and also the fact that you have some misalignment between the spin or angular momentum and the orbital angular momentum. And then lastly, you have the orbit itself. And most of the time, as in effectively always, we assume a quasi-circular orbit. But if there are signs of eccentricity, that is another very strong indicator for the specific formation history. But I'll start off with the mass. And the mass of the black holes, the inferred masses of the black holes we have seen so far, are shown in this plot here. So you have the primary mass, which we have defined to be whatever mass is the heaviest out of the two in the binary, and then the secondary mass. And I think Salva showed something like this yesterday. But the thing that is interesting that has been mentioned in the past as well, is that these ones up here are very heavy. The ones at the bottom are more comparable to the black hole masses seen in X-ray binaries, but even so, they're still on the heavier end, or consistent with being on the heavier end, at least. And also, everything we've seen so far are sufficiently connected to this diagonal line up here, meaning they're consistent with being equal mass or close to equal mass. And so I don't remember the exact the lines on this plot which correspond to different mass ratios, but I think for 15 and 14, we can exclude most mass ratios below or greater than 2 in this case. And we're finally at the stage where we have where the binaries observed by LIGO are actually overlapping. So shortly, the plot that we can show here will be ugly and not very readable, which is a good thing. But one thing you can start doing when you have a number of these masses is to try and tune for the mass distribution. And this has been done for so excluding the orange one and the blue one down here, but keeping the other four. And so assuming a mass distribution of the primary mass, or the heavier one, with some power, which we'll come back to in a minute, and then given the fact that we only look for certain types of binaries, there are some additional constraints. So for example, we don't look in this specific search, we haven't looked for binaries with masses above 100 solar masses or below 5 solar masses. All those have been excluded at least. And if you then try to figure out what the power law index is, it is consistent with 2.3. So again, at the moment, we're still very much consistent with the Salpeter power law of alpha of 2.35. And with more.
What is the Salpeter power law?
No, it's not a Salpeter. It's a Krupa and Mischel mass function, probably. I think.
Oh, okay.
Yes, sorry. I think I've written the Salpeter law here, but I think that is very much wrong.
No, but where does the 2.35? I don't care how it's called. Where it's coming from.
Salpeter, that's right. That is Salpeter. It's dnd log m for, I'm sorry, dndm for massive stars.
Yeah,
but Krupa rounds it off at low mass.
Basically, if you extrapolate the same power law and scale it down for black holes exactly, you would. This is what you're doing. So you're just scaling down by fixing.
Yeah, but people argue about variations in. IMF, the star formation, initial mass function, much better than the width of the Gaussian.
Yeah, yeah. No, so like, so we're centered at this point, but we're also consistent with many other power laws. So.
It's a tantalizing suggestion.
Yes.
Yeah.
Carl, I can see that you would kind of restrict things at about 100 solar masses and not search for them, but you're searching for everything that is below 5, because when you start.
So in the mass distribution analysis, there was an assumption of, if we think that the mass gap between neutron stars and black hole exists, then since we only assume binary black hole systems in for this specific analysis, so this plot was made before the binary neutron star detection. That's why this lower limit imposed. But But at the same time, like at the lower mass bounds, we're not very well constrained at the moment anyway.
But how robust is 5 solar masses star physically?
There are still yet to be any black holes observed in below 5 solar masses.
Well,
anywhere, I think.
We may have one.
Right? You mean after the
neutron
star? Yeah. No. Yes. Yeah, no, so that would be a 2.7 solar mass black hole, which would be great. But I think that's, so this mass distribution still own, I don't remember if it includes like second generation black holes, or like merger remnants as a initial assumption. Yeah, Padre?
Cannot, right? I mean, I was thinking about, so that would imply having larger, each event you get 3 black holes in, right, if we include the remnants.
Yes. Yeah, no, so this only includes information about the initial, or the primary of the initial binary.
Then why not include, in fact, the third black hole?
I don't really have a good answer for that.
Find out here is the population, the channel that forms it, and you're kind of excluding
the
channel.
You're excluding that, right? You're assuming that.
Yeah, but statistically, that must be a very small fraction.
I don't know.
Well, so I'm going to come back to second generation black holes.
You can count the number of stars in the galaxy and the number of LIGO events that have been observed in the galaxy. Infer how rare that is, right? So.
Well, that's not, okay, anyway, that's not necessarily the relevant thing, because they're only looking at the ones that are merging. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but,
yes, so. Swiftly going onwards. So one of the main formation channels that have been proposed are this galactic field formation, mm-hmm. where you start off with some heavy stars that are born at these masses in the main sequence. After some amount of time, so this is time here in mega years. And then you have the masses of the objects on this side, the secondary masses, and then the separation between them. So after some time, you have the primary star, which overflows its Roche lobe and starts a mass transfer period onto the secondary. So you lose a So in this case, you lose a fair amount of mass in not a very short time. So you lose nearly half the mass in this case, or slightly more than half the mass, which means that now the secondary object is the more heavier one.
So in this case, they're very close by. When you create a black hole, what is the probability that you eject the star out to whatever?
So,
eject it out of the binary, because when you go supernova, you still go. I mean, you still have to go supernova in this process, right, to form the black hole.
Yes.
So why doesn't the what's the probability that you eject the companion star during the process?
Or just push it far away.
They don't merge within the edge of the universe anymore.
So I have some plots about that later. I don't think.
Yeah.
So I don't remember the exact fractions in these simulations.
Yeah.
But so what's shown on this side is an example binary which was consistent with the first detection.
I see.
So it's just this is one example which survived, but there's
probably many
billions and billions which didn't.
Why don't this one mean the direct black hole means direct collapse without a supernova?
Yeah.
Is
there such a thing? Sufficiently
yes.
Oh.
Good point, actually.
Oh, okay. Oh, so that can happen. Okay. Yeah, that would be different if you don't have.
So I understand one direct to black hole, right? You eliminate the envelope of one, you're left with the core, which would collapse if it got massive enough. Doesn't it need some amount of additional accretion to get massive enough to collapse?
Yeah.
And then isn't the second direct black hole hard to understand? I mean, the first one maybe.
Yes. Well, so the helium cores you're left with at the end are roughly the same mass in this case. So the fact that both of them undergo direct collapse at that point is fine. But then whether you would have the setup as a common pathway is one choice among many. But so as an example, as an additional example to show the variability in various universes you can have. So this is these are a set of simulations. So instead of just one, I have a large number of thousand simulations, where the top row has an initial metallicity corresponding to 10% of solar metallicity, and then the bottom row has a 5% solar metallicity. And if you then compare so I should also say in the left column you have the masses of the zero H main sequence mass, so the mass of the stars as they're born on the main sequence. And M1 is here defined as the more heavier one of more heavier initial mass, and M2 is the lighter initial mass. And then in the right column, you have the corresponding black hole masses formed from these binaries. So one thing which is interesting to see is that now you have some M1 values being above this diagonal, so M1 in this case being smaller than M2, meaning that you've had some fairly efficient mass transfer going on. So where this initially lighter star was given enough mass by the primary such that it could make a more heavy remnant. And the other thing as well is that, as you see, for the higher metallicity case, you actually don't form any binaries corresponding to GW1514. So for it to actually form, you require a fairly low metallicity. And this is true also for the other formation channels in general as well.
So just to understand, so you took black holes that were consistent with these events, and then you went back and saw which...
They did go the other way around. I think they started with some mass distribution of stars, evolved them, and then did a check for which ones are consistent.
The dots that were consistent.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and so the boundaries here are the 90% credible limit in chap mass and the mass ratio as well.
I have another question. Yeah. So, of course, the left-hand side plot is not drawn to scale. Like, can you comment on what are the different length scales in this problem? Roughly, how far they are from each other and how big the blobs actually become.
So the last. So I don't have a measure for the size of the objects themselves, but the numbers in this column are the orbital separation, so the semi-major axis of the orbits. So you have a few thousand solar orbits or solar radii initially, and that wobbles about a bit, but it's still roughly a few thousand throughout the lifetime, and then you require this common envelope phase to bring it down to a few tens of solar radii, at which point you make the other object into a black hole, and after that you have you're dominated by gravitational waves. But this is also 5 billion years where the binary is just sitting around.
No, it's not 5 billion, it's mega years, right? It's 10 million years. Oh, this
There's
is
a thousand.
That's a thousand.
The point is European. No,
oh, it's a European, yeah. This is European? If it's European, then it exists.
Yeah, no, so this is a comma.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Okay. Anywho.
But it's
European. Large amount of time.
Okay.
Can I ask you a question? You might talk about this later, if so, and just continue. But this is a cartoon, and I realize people do population synthesis calculations in which they assign values to the cartoon features. How certain are those now? And, I mean, there's a couple points that we could pick on, like mass loss or the common envelope phase.
So the common envelope is by far the least uncertain, or the most uncertain. And most population synthesis codes model this phase as some common envelope efficiency, which follows some distribution. And that's it. As in, you start off with some masses and separations initially, you multiply that by a number, and then you end up with the end product. And however you deal with this, there's loads of fairly complex both dynamics and gas physics and so on that goes on in that phase. And I think there's been some simulations for probably only lighter objects, which can try to model the common envelope phase. But even so, it's not a very well understood phase.
And what about observations? So it's never been observed, right?
Very short.
phase, right?
Yeah, and I think I have a vague memory of there being like maybe one case that was that one observed bunny, which could have been in the common envelope phase, but it was not. I don't remember the exact configuration.
So then, how does that uncertainty impact the implications for understanding the binary evolution associated with the mergers?
It can impact it quite a lot in the sense that, like, when you do this, when you set up these large population studies, you pick a configuration for the envelope phase and every single other bit in here. There's two different sets of problems. One is the fact that you have a very large set of different variables, and they are sufficiently unknown and also of a sufficient large number that you probably don't have enough computers to try every single combination of every single thing. And then on top of that, there are... So for example, with the mass transfer, that you can do more detailed hydrodynamical simulations of binaries and how they would do mass transfer itself. But then again, you can probably only do that for a smaller selection and then try to interpolate between them in some hopefully robust way.
So the last question is, historically people have tried to calibrate these with things like double binary pulsars and other such objects. How many of the degeneracies or uncertainties can be set that way for this sort of analysis, and how many are going to be unique to LIGO?
Well, so the binary neutron star cases will not be directly, well, they will be somewhat informative to these ones, but there's still the processes with which you form a black hole binary or binary black hole as opposed to a binary neutron star differs a bit as well. So I think you can do some, you can probably put some constraints on the possible universes you can have from the observation so far, but even then you're left with a large set of freedom which you can tweak around. Another formation channel, which came to prominence a few years ago, is so instead of having, at this stage, you have a binary which fills its rush lobe and then does mass transfer, if you have a highly rotating, really massive star, you can have quite efficient mixing between the different layers in the star itself. So instead of just having a helium-rich core with the hydrogen envelope, which then expands and flows over to through the companion, you can have the helium mix efficiently throughout the star, which then suppresses the expansion and also for that specific reason, you don't get as any or as much mass transfer to the companion. So with this way, it's easier in some ways to make really heavy black holes. And as shown in the plot on the right, so this would be the binaries or the binary masses or the binary total mass, which could be observed in LIGO at the sign sensitivity at the rate given at the color bar. But in general, the thing to keep in mind up here is that everything we see from this specific channel will be really heavy and also very close to equal mass. And I'll skip along a bit to keep on time, hopefully. The last major formation channel is the dynamical formation channel. It's the one I like the most. And the setup here is that instead of just having a binary, which is born together and then evolve together, and then hopefully stay as a binary for the entire lifetime of itself, you can have, if you have a sufficiently dense stellar environment, so for example in global clusters, and but this also applies to nuclear cluster in galaxies, the stellar number density is so high that you have that the probability of any binary or any object having a strong encounter with another single object or sometimes another binary is effectively one. So again, what's shown on the right are two different evolutionary paths, which both end up in something that is consistent with the first LIGO detection. And I won't go into all the details, but as you can see, there are a large number of different and interesting and also very strong encounters that happens in this case. And the good thing about that is that every time you have a strong encounter, you effectively scramble up any orientational preference you can have in a binary. So with the classical formation channel, so the field formation channel, you expect both black hole spins to be roughly aligned with the orbital angular momentum. With the dynamical formation channel, that is really not the case. You can safely assume a completely isotropic spin distribution. And yeah, so as an example of what can be the types of binaries that can be produced and the types of binaries can be detected, there's still a somewhat preference for against heavier binaries. And also, especially so, for the ones that can be detected. So the blue distribution has undergone a selection based on what we could have detected in the first observation run of LIGO. So with both in the second observation run and also with upcoming observations, the preference or the strong selection for only heavier stuff will be less strong.
How likely are those encounters to give you a relatively a circular merger versus something that's very elliptical?
So I have some good plots about that towards the end.
Okay.
But in general, even if you can form something fairly eccentric, the time. So we didn't put the time on this axis up here, I think. Yeah, it's not very clear at least. There usually is sufficient amount of time such that when after the last interaction, usually what happens is, or what was assumed in this case is that the last interaction gives the binary such a strong kick, which means that it's ejected from the cluster. After which it assumed that it just sails across the universe doing nothing apart from circularizing at that point. So even though you can form, the interactions can form something fairly eccentric, unless you merge very rapidly after that, you're gonna have a fairly circular binary in the end. But it's not a zero probability of you having eccentric merger after this. So, spoiler for the future: if you have something that's eccentric, that is more or less a certainty of coming from a dynamical formation. Because with the field binaries, those have had billions of years to circularize, and that's fine. So going on to spins, we have observed a number of black holes again. And you might have seen these plots in the past. So what's shown here is on the vertical axis is the spin magnitude, and then also the tilt angle across away from the orbital angular momentum. And the takeaway message from this slide is that this is the only thing that matters. This has a effectively zero probability at zero. And also, if you imagine that you take these half circular distribution and squish them onto this axis and combine them with in a sufficiently mass weighted way, that gives you the effective spin. So as long as you don't have any spin support below, or any dominant spin support below the horizontal line here, that's an actual spin measurement. Everything else is just pretty blobs. So to partially answer one of the questions from earlier, so one thing that's interesting to see is what types of spin misalignments can you have in different formation scenarios. So I'll start by just describing the black lines. Those are the spin tilt distributions you can assume in a dynamical formation channel, i.e. you're safe to assume completely isotropic spin tilt angles. Then the other misalignment assumptions depend both on the black hole kick, which in the most realistic scenario is this fallback kick. So you take a kick distribution based off a Maxwellian distribution with input from the galactic pulsars, and then say that based on the fractional fallback mass of that happens in the supernova, that will set the magnitude for the kick. And then you can either have a completely isotropic kick distribution, so kicks in any direction whatsoever, or the paper also assumed a polar distribution, so where you have the kick in effectively a 10-degree cone around the spin axis. They also tried this proportional kick, so where you just rescale the kick's magnitude with the ratio of the maximum neutron star mass, which in this case is 2.5 solar masses, with the mass of the actual black hole that you formed. And then the most optimistic and also most unrealistic distribution is just that there's no difference between black hole kicks and neutron star kicks. They're all the same.
Is there any theory that selects
So I think most supernova models would definitely favor the fallback model. I don't think anyone believes that this would be true. But so it's mostly there for an extreme case as a comparison. And then the proportional kick is a fairly general or like ignorant choice of another kick model. But I think in many ways, the fallback kicks is the model that people believe, and then there are variations in how you think the fallback actually works. But that's roughly the thing. Yes, so to do these, to look at these models, the authors of the paper created a population of stellar masses and evolved them with both a stellar evolution code and then also some dynamical evolution as well. And then in here you select it down for the binaries which form the bound binary. I should also mention that in the fallback case, above a Chapp mass of roughly 15 solar masses, the tilt you get is effectively zero. So that's why it's not shown up here. But even so, in general, apart from the full kick model, it's fairly hard to get kicks which can take you from being aligned with the orbital angular momentum at 0 degrees to not being aligned.
So in this plot, the assumption is that the stars starts off having a line spin. Okay.
Yeah. Or there might be some like little scatter around that, but effectively all aligned.
Yeah, which makes sense. Okay.
Yeah. But then again, in the...
Sorry, have they seen binaries where the two stars are anti, like going like this? Is that possible?
It's an unstable, there is a torque, so there would be...
No, I know there would be a torque, but it depends on the distance, right? They're very far away, so...
The close binaries would tidally lock.
And then they would just, very, very quickly, that would happen very fast.
That's all.
Okay.
Yeah. But then again, like we know that neutron star binaries, for example, can have fairly substantial kicks. So the binary pulsar is one of the neutron stars in there have a slightly more than 90% or 90-degree tilt, for example. And I'm not talking about binary neutron stars in this presentation specifically, but in general, binary neutron stars are difficult to make in the dynamical case. And they're also very difficult to make in every other single case as well. So it's difficult to set up a universe which can create both the sufficient number of binary black holes and sufficient number of binary neutron stars, given the rates that we have now observed.
What do you mean by sufficient?
So if you assume that, so if you set up a universe such that you can make binaries at a merger rate which is consistent with the one we infer from our observations at the moment, that universe isn't able to generate as many binary neutron stars as it should do.
Through which process? Through all of them, or through this dynamic capture?
Through all of them, I think.
So, is there one or two parameters in these, like population synthesis codes that are in tension here with the two different populations, or what? These would explain it.
What
if all the binary black holes came from dynamical formation, and then all the.
Yeah. So that would be the easiest way, because the dynamical formation channel is really good at making black holes and really bad at making binary neutron stars. The field formation channel can produce either, but there's then a selection, if you want, to which configuration of the universe you would need to make either type of binary.
Why is there a difference between black holes and neutron stars for the dynamical channel?
It's mostly dependent on the fact that, so very simplified, if you have a globular cluster, you form a black hole binary, or a binary black hole, which then undergoes strong interactions with other objects. And then you have exchanges between the components of the binary and then any interloper that comes nearby. And that, so in that possible exchange, the highest probability outcome is that you end up with a binary with the two heaviest things.
If you have all mass scale.
Yeah. So you have a preference for having the binary with the two heaviest things in the cluster at the moment.
We were just talking about the dynamical capture scenario, right? This was for the evolutionary scenario, or am I totally wrong? Am I confused about what these pictures are for?
So the color things are the normal field formation channels, not the common envelope, or not the...
globular cluster.
No, so the black lines are for the globular clusters, and the colored are for the field formation channels, so with common envelope evolution in there.
Okay.
But I think you, yeah.
So for the dynamic capture scenario, is the difference in the different spin cross sections accounted for? It's easier to capture something into a retrograde orbit, or is that not a sizable effect?
I don't think it's formally that is formally included in here, but I think every check that I've seen in the past have found that to be negligible.
Okay.
So to summarize this a bit, given the gray line that is at 50%, so if you have a cluster formation channel, you have a 50% chance of having a chi-effective smaller than zero, so having some misalignment. And for every other case, so every case in the field formation channel, that probability is small at low masses and insignificant at higher masses, apart from the isotropic full kick model, but that again, that's probably excluded already. I will skip this bit.
Sorry.
So this is similar. This is partially part of what Salvo talked about yesterday.
Okay. Yeah, I guess one of the questions. Sorry, I know we're asking a lot of questions. Well, we'll let you go over time. Don't.
Well, you can ask your question now.
No, it's just Salvo was saying in terms of the priors for how much the information you extract depends on the priors, but it seems from what you're arguing here, it might be reasonable to assume, at least for some subset of the black holes you see, if they're formed in this dynamical, in the field case,
yes.
You could put the prior from that and see what information you extract on this.
Yes, so that the field formation would correspond to P5, the green one, where we assume a misalignment or a Gaussian misalignment of with a sigma of 10 degrees.
Right.
So
in that case, you can extract information on the individual.
Yes, but I will skip forward to this slide, which I don't think Salva showed. So as part of this study, one thing we looked at was both. So we computed the KL divergence, which is a statistical measure for how much information you have gained given some analyzed data. So this is the information in bits between the prior assumption we have made and the posterior distribution for each analyzed binary. And in general, and also both for the chi-effective parameter and also this chi-p parameter, which characterizes the precession level or amount of precession in the binary. For chi-p, we don't really see anything. So we don't gain any information in any event, really, under any prior assumptions, apart from this the P5 distribution, so the aligned distribution in here, where we do gain at least comparably large amount of information, but at the same time, if you compute an odds ratio between the standard prior assumption, which is uniform in spin magnitude and then isotropic in spin orientation, so if you compute the odds ratio or the log odds ratio between the evidence for this model and every single other model, you see that even though we gain quite a lot of information, we actually we still prefer the original spin assumptions by, again, comparatively quite a lot. But even so, there are some statements you can make from this which are somewhat or quite astrophysically relevant. So for 15914, we can say that under all the prior variations we have in here, the magnitude of the spins for both black holes are probably smaller than 0.3. So at least for this binary, the spins are probably small. But again, there are configurations which are not excluded, which have larger spins. And for P4, the purple one is a bimodal distribution where you have a small spin mode, which would be then consistent with all the black holes we see, and then a high spin mode, which is consistent with all the black holes Jack see. And then for 15 and 14, we prefer just the lower spin mode. So again, that's a useful statement under those variations. And everything we see is fully consistent with chi effective being zero. So again, that's good.
15, 12, 26 also had lighter black holes, right?
Yeah, so the total mass ratio, or the ratio between the total masses for these is like 3 or 4 or something.
Okay.
For 15, 12, 26, everything we see excludes a chi effective of zero at 99% confidence. So again, how hard we try, there needs to be some amount of spin in there at least. And then finally, this binary, LVT-15-2012, that's the one which only has 90% astrophysical significance, i.e. we don't have very strong inference from the data for this event, meaning that the priors we subject this binary to are fairly dominant. So that's fine. Yes?
What was P5 again?
P5 is the aligned spin model. So where you have, so we assume uniform in spin magnitude, and then only a 10 degree scatter around the orbital angular momentum.
So I guess you can use this odd ratio to compare different models, right? Like, we combine all the events and see which model is actually preferred over the rest?
We haven't done the actual comparison, but I would be surprised if anything would stand out with any large significance. There are some population statements that I hopefully will be able to cover in the last 5 minutes. But as per usual, it'll probably run over a bit. I'll skip this. So going onward to the spin population assumptions. So in here, this is a paper by Will Farr et al. In here, they assumed distributions for chi-effectives, which are Gaussian, corresponding to the bounds that we had seen. As Salva talked about yesterday, that's not entirely a good choice to make for the distributions. But for the purpose of the study, it's probably fine. So what you can test is to see if the population of binaries you have are consistent with being drawn from a distribution which is flat in spin, one which prefers low spins, or one which prefers high spins. And then also whether you prefer an aligned spin system or any isotropic configuration. So if you take these distributions for the individual spins, combining with the mass constraints, or the mass prior, you get out these distributions for chi-effective. And then what you can do is you can test for how well your population of binaries, which are these four, correspond to being generated by either of these distributions. And the preferred one is this LI distribution, which is the low spin distribution with an isotropic spin alignment. And the odds ratios you have here, or the base factors, are with respect to the preferred model. And even so if you say that you still would like to have an aligned spin model as your generator distribution, The preferred one is still the low spin one, but you're still have a preference for any of the isotropic distributions at this stage. An alternative population model was done by Ben Farr, so another Farr, where you can test what, so you can do a one parameter test, or zero parameter test, for where the spins you have are consistent with being positive or negative. If you find that they are negative, then that probably means that you have an isotropic spin distribution. But what they found, so what they compute here, or what they show, are the odds ratios for being isotropic when assuming various aligned spin models and various isotropic models. If you assume isotropic models after a few tens of events, you can say that this is isotropic with fairly high significance. But, and for most aligned spin systems, you still prefer, or you disfavor the isotropic model, unless you have really, really low spins, at which point you can't say anything, because the spins are fairly close to zero. And if you check for, so if you do a test for a couple of hundred events with this, with really small spin magnitudes, and test for whether that distribution comes from either an isotropic aligned model, you really can't tell them apart. So this initial model was extended to have one negative chi-effective bin, one positive chi-effective bin. This limit is wrong. I copied this from that paper, so hopefully, or from the archive version, so hopefully it's changed in the paper. But at least you have a, so you have a little, very narrow bin centered around chi-effective of zero. So if there's something that's low spin or isotropic and in the plane, it will be sucked up by that bin. And so again, redoing the same analysis as before, with a very low spin distribution, assuming a very low spin distribution, you can check for the fraction of informative events, so the number of events which are not in the central chi-effective zero bin, and that's nearly none, which in this case is good, because that's what you assumed. And also the fraction of informative events, so the number of events, or the fraction of the events you've looked at which had negative chi-effective, so signs for isotropy. And for this case, that's ill-constrained. But now, if you compute the same base factors, all the base factors are in the direction they should be at least. So that's a good thing. If you look at the four detections they had, so the three binary black holes from the first observation run and the January event from the second one, now you have some actual slightly more meaningful constraints on the spin distributions. You have a quarter of the events being informative. So 15, 12, 26 has a spin, which is not zero. So a quarter of your events actually tell you something. And then so then the fraction of events which has chi-effective, with positive chi-effective is close to one, because again, you have one informative event. So at this stage, they prefer an aligned spin model, because that's their assumption. But with more events, more detections, this could easily shuffle around a bit. I will skip onwards a bit to eccentricity. I can mention that this is another spin population study where they, instead of looking just at chi-effective, they looked directly at the spin tilt angles and then did inference on various models on the spin tilt angles. And with some a few tens of events, you can distinguish various populations and various universes.
Just one question. With the spin posteriors presented in the paper, so these pi diagrams, presumably the actual posterior is something with some kind of correlation between the two, rather than just independent things. How much, if you're comparing those diagrams to the chi-effective parameter, how much information, is there any information in the chi-effective parameter that isn't presented in those diagrams because of correlations, or?
So the pi diagrams they're constructed in such a way that they contain all the correlation information we have access to. They are marginalized over the polar or the azimuthal angles of the spin distributions, but you still have all the tilt information that we have access to, meaning you don't have access to very much.
Okay, so basically there's almost no correlation between the posteriors.
No, and also, so this also ties back to the fact that while you present the spin magnitude and tilt angles in those pi diagrams, the parameters we actually measure are, or that we can put constraints on, are the effective spin and also this chi-p parameter. And the chi-p parameter, in the way that it's constructed, means that you only get information from the more massive black hole.
I mean, yes, mostly it's one is a blob and the other is...
Yeah. So, quick foray into eccentricity. As I mentioned, most things we're going to see in LIGO, they're not going to be very eccentric. So an alternative, if you want to distinguish different information channels, is to look earlier on in the binary evolution. So here you're looking at the eccentricity at 1 millihertz, i.e. in the LISA band. Mm-hmm. If you have observations of binary black holes in the LISA band, then you can do direct measurements of the eccentricity, and you also get fairly nice separation between different populations in this mass eccentricity plot. So you have all the binaries. The black ones are the binaries formed in globular clusters, so again with isotropic spin distributions. And a selection of eccentricities. And then the blue and the green are binaries formed in the Fiedel formation channel, but with no common envelope phase or one common envelope phase.
LISA won't be good at measuring spins, right? How far away are they? I mean, the objects are far away. So let's say something that's in the LIGO band today, a year ago, would have been in the LISA band or something, right?
Yes. So
the question is, couldn't you combine data once you have that? You present here the example with eccentricity. If you had observed the object out in the LISA band, if you had that information, the waveform, would that help with parameter determination?
Yes. Like? Yes. So there is a nice paper by A. Salvo have looked at this.
Yeah.
But there's an earlier paper by Alberto Sassana, which was published just after the first LIGO detection, where he looked at the given a collection of binaries consistent with 5914, how would they have looked in LISA?
Mm-hmm.
And like you get, you determine the chirp mass to like a fraction of a percent, or probably even smaller. I think he didn't include any spins in his paper, but the fact that you get the chirp mass really well, I think you also got the mass ratio really well. I would be surprised if you also, if you included properly the spin parameters in that distribution or in that assumption, you would get very good constraints on those as well. And additionally, you get, if you have an observation in LISA, you get a prediction for the merger time within a few seconds at most. So you know exactly when the merge is going to happen, and you also know exactly where in the sky it's going to happen. So again, please give money to your favorite funding agency so that they can build the next generation detector.
Can I come?
Yeah.
So I mean, the spins in the phase, they enter at 1.5 pm. The spin orbit interaction enters at 1.5 pm, and the spin-spin interaction enters at 2 pm. So this means that even at low frequencies, so whatever is below 2.5 pm, at low frequencies, if you take frequency to zero, it blows up. So at low frequencies, you will have information from spins. So I expect Lisa to actually be able to
put the spin. Yes, no, but then doing a proper analysis with LISA data is, again...
No, of course. The future.
Difficult.
Yes.
And also we have 20 years 20 years to figure that out,
yes.
so we're good.
No. It's an academic question.
So I'll finish on this. So this is a study on the spins of the merger objects. So if you assume initially non-spinning objects, you have spins of the merger remnant at 1.67 and a bit. And then if you assume that you can have some or a very high spin, initial spin distribution, that broadens that distribution out a bit, but you're still fairly, you're still gonna end up with high or comparatively high spinning objects. And then you can repeat these mergers again. So if you have a third generation hierarchical merger, if you start off with non-spinning binaries, the first or the second generation population has spin of this. A third generation set of mergers have the blue distribution, and the fourth generation has the green distribution, and so on. So if you can observe these and capture these, and also, if you're interested in black holes with high spins, the merger remnants might be a good and somewhat safe option, at least. Because however you mush these around, it's fairly difficult to get an initial low spin, at least. Even more hilariously, if you start off with a triple, so the blue, green, and red are all individual black holes in a triple system. You can, I think I have a zoom in. Yes. So you start off with chaotic interaction out here.
Yeah.
Eventually, they separate. So the green one is still loosely bound, but the blue and the red one are tightly bound. They merge together, they're recaptured by the green one, and then you have a secondary merger.
Sorry, how probable is such a scenario?
It is not very probable. So the constraints for this to happen is that you need everything to be effectively coplanar.
I see.
And then also you need a sufficiently dense stellar environment so that you have some probability of triples happening. But in most globular clusters, having triples is not difficult, or making triples is not difficult.
Yeah, yeah.
Then the phase space of having things coplanar is more difficult. But again, and I think if you get this binary to be fairly eccentric, the delay time between these two binaries can be a few hours at the least, which would be great. What I'll finish on is a new study from Carl Rodriguez. So again, this is dynamical formation, where in the previous simulations he'd done, most of the binary interactions were done just assuming Newtonian gravity. But we know that sometimes post-Newtonian corrections are important. So in here, he turned them on all the time, which means that you increase the number of binaries by quite a lot. And while previously, so I mentioned that normally the binaries you make, so you make them in the cluster and then you kick them out. These correspond to the blue dots up here. But now that you have more powerful in-cluster interaction, you are also likely to have in-cluster mergers. And if those in-cluster mergers are relatively light, the kicks apply to the to the merger kicks can be low enough that you're not ejected by the cluster, which means that you can have repeated mergers. And so these repeated merges have a slightly different distribution in mass, primarily because you take lighter stuff and put them together. If you then take the remnants of that and want to put those together with other things, you have a preference for higher mass in general. Which also means that you can have really, really heavy mass binaries formed without too much trouble. The colored plots and also the solid black one in here assumes black hole spins of zero, because the higher the birth spins of the black holes you have, the higher the magnitude of the magic kicks you're going to have as well. So if you have really, really highly spinning black holes, you're more likely to get kicked out of the cluster. So with the higher birth spins you can have, the lower the probability of having repeated mergers you're going to have. But again, like you still have a few, but now definitely more at lower masses than before. And with the repeated mass, or with the in-cluster mergers, you can also have a number of high eccentricity mergers in the LIGO band as well. And yeah, so the right plot is effectively the same as I said before. So to finish up, we have a large number of black holes seen so far. The number of blue dots on here is going to go up quite rapidly, hopefully, in the next year. And maybe similar with the purple plots. And then also the yellow and orange ones as well. And I want to finish on something slightly more hopeful than something that I've mentioned. So the general conclusion is that measuring black hole spins is difficult. We can't say very much. This is not always the case. So this is a simulated signal that I ran for fun, effectively. So you have a neutron star black hole binary where the mass ratio of nearly 10 or 9, 8 or 9 or something. So you constrain the individual masses really well. And now you're not near the equal mass limit, so that's good. And similarly, so I picked a spin configuration which is not crazy. So you have the black hole spin, the black hole has a spin of like 0.6. The neutron star has a spin of 0.04. So that's pretty high for a neutron star in binary. But even so, you get constraints on the black hole spin, or you get really good constraints on the black hole spin. And now both the components along the orbital angular momentum and the one parallel to it, or the one perpendicular to it. So in the future, once we have bumped up a number of detections by a bit, hopefully something like this could be observed. But again, the ways with which the astrophysical motivation for such a binary to exist are by far less explored than the more equal mass cases, both for binary black holes and binary neutron stars. So if we see something like this, getting the black hole spin measurements is easy, but it's still an outstanding question whether we can see something like this in the first place.
By the way, this assumes that your spin is, the magnitude is like 0.7 or 0.8 to begin with. So does it, if you keep the mass ratio large and you were to make the spin, let's say 0.4, 0.3, would you still have the same nice precision that you show there?
It wouldn't be as nice,
yeah,
I think, but like it should still be pretty good.
Okay. Yeah, because
and like it, so I don't know exactly, but I would assume that you're still like the blob probably extends a bit in size, But you can probably still exclude the zero parts.
Yeah, okay.
Well, Michalis?
What happened to the spin of the neutron star?
It is unconstrained.
Yes.
Okay.
Completely.
Yeah. Yeah, no, so yeah, so there is a distribution on here, but it's uniform across the whole space.
What is the distance?
The signal to noise ratio of this? 15. So this is a fairly moderately you don't need a super loud signal to get spin measurements like this. The only thing you require is the signal to have a long duration in the band of LIGO. And this goes on, this is easily observable for a minute in band. And that was everything I wanted to say. Thank you.